Hello and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast. We are your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Tosin Anafawakin, and Andrew Sorsini can't join us today. He's under the weather, so we hope he feels better. We just watched the fifth episode of Starz American Gods second season titled The Ways of the Dead. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. So let's dive into the after talk. But first, we wanted to catch you up on how to reach us. Here are our online links. Follow us at Twitter at Gods Podcast or hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is at Podcast American Gods. You can write or send us a voicemail at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. Add us on iTunes, like us, and please leave us a review. Dwayne, give us a recap of what happened in this episode.
You got it. All right. So we start off with multiple slow motion scenes depicting a graphic lynching of a black American in the early 1900s. Shadow wakes as if from a dream and doesn't seem to have control over his body. As he looks into the mirror, we see his head on fire and his body full of bullet holes. He's haunted by the lynched man. Meanwhile, the leaves given to Salim in the gym are planted in soil and then urinated on by Mr. Wednesday. He refers to it as Yggdrasil. Shadow asks what he's doing. Wednesday leaves Shadow along with Ibis. In historic downtown Cairo, Mr. Nancy crosses paths with a youth and decides to follow him. We see the youth purchase drugs from a house and then quickly get stopped by cops. He runs as the cops give chase. The youth is stopped in his tracks when he sees the disembodied head of the lynched man we saw earlier on a pole. The police capture him as he points to the site in disbelief. Back at Ibis's funeral home, Ibis shows Shadow a dead body, riddled with bullet holes, and with a burnt head. The corpse is the grandson of the elder woman that we saw last episode. Shadow discloses that in the mirror, he had the same wounds. Then Ibis tells him that he's being haunted by Froggy James. He tells the story of Froggy James, who was caught crossing paths and looking at a white woman, and who later turned up dead. James was arrested. The mob kidnapped him from the sheriff's protection and lynched and then mutilated and burned him before a crowd of 10,000 or more. Nancy interrupts Shadow and Ibis, and then Shadow leaves them to find the spirit of Froggy James. They discuss Froggy James' haunting. James claims that black people are unloved and thus he's bringing them the sweet release of death. He curses Shadow. A possessed and cursed Shadow then speaks grimly at the funeral of the older woman that we met last episode. When Nancy interrupts Shadow and Shadow leaves, he accuses Ibis of having black people killed in order to thrive as an undertaker god. Elsewhere within the funeral home, the preacher tells Ruby Goodchild, the granddaughter and sister of the two dead people, that she should make no rash decisions in the wake of these tragedies because she's interested in leaving the town with Bilkis. Bilkis says that they should stay a while and that she shouldn't make any rash decisions. Down in Louisiana, Mad Sweeney is drunk at some sort of parade. Laura shows up as he passes out. She's looking for a more permanent solution to her problem than the temporary restoration that killing Argus gave her. Mad Sweeney takes Laura to a bar where they meet the Baron and Bridget, who attempt to help Laura later that evening, giving her back senses of taste, smell, and touch. They're both Loas, and they make a deal with Sweeney and Laura, a truth for her resurrection. The Baron gives Laura a vial of potion, but tells her that one ingredient is missing, two drops of blood infused with love. Laura sleeps with the Baron, and Mad Sweeney separately sleeps with Bridget, the Baron's wife. They phase in and out during their individual sex encounters, and it seems as if at one point Laura and Sweeney are actually making love to one another. She wakes with a vial sealed nearby and leaves. On her way out, she encounters Mad Sweeney and they have a falling out. Meanwhile, the Djinn and Salim are on a roadside. Their motorcycle's breaking down. They discuss the difference between the Djinn and Islam and how the Djinn feels incompatible with Islam. Wednesday comes to retrieve them and the quote-unquote spear, which resides in the guitar case they picked up at the Porn Palace a little while ago. They drive off to meet Alvis, Norse king of the dwarves. He tells Wednesday that he cannot fix the spear named Gungir, And that Wednesday needs to go and see their rune master, Dvalin. At day's end, Wednesday, Ibis and Mr. Nancy share beers in the office of the funeral home. They tell jokes and discuss America. They avoid Shadow's questions upsetting him. In the pot where Wednesday urinated, the plant has gone from a sprig to a large branched thing, the beginnings of a tree. That's the recap.
Yeah, thanks for the recap there, Dwayne. This episode felt a bit more fluid than the last one. So I guess let's hop into the salient points about this episode. So first thing, of course, it is called The Way of the Dead. And I think there's several meanings of that that are reflected pretty obviously on the surface for this episode. First, there's the Loa, which mm-hmm. is the spirits of Haitian or Louisiana voodoo that we see portraying throughout the, you know, imagery used in the episode, as well as in a lot of the scenes that you see with Mad Sweeney and Laura. Some other things, you mentioned the potential ghosts, quote unquote, of Froggy James.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty creepy.
Yeah. So that is pretty dead, but also sort of reflecting towards the future. We'll talk a bit more about that. One of the things that Andy has mentioned before is the memento mori. So that's remember that you must die. And that kind of seems to be something that's casted on Shadow, that he needs to somehow die before the battle has been won.
It's like the Roman version of Valor Morghulis in Game of Thrones, like all men must die.
Exactly, exactly. And another thing that directly comes from the title, The Ways of the Dead, is actually a book by Neely Tucker. And that book kind of talks about a dead body of a teenage girl being discovered in the shadows, and then police arresting local black kids as the suspect, and kind of the investigation and the journalism around that event. So kind of spot on, to be honest, except this deals with a more historical fact here.
Yeah, but it definitely reflects the story of Froggy James, exactly. As was told by Ibis, yeah.
Yeah. And finally, also, Laura's dead, or so we think. She's been dead, but she's starting to become more alive, and we're starting to discover more about her truth, and is it really Shadow that she is tied to, or is there something else behind that? So there's quite a lot packed into the title, some of it on the surface, but a lot of the sort of deeper meanings being pulled out in this episode.
I sort of love the fact that the title is full of it.
Yeah, exactly. And you, when you think about it, like, yeah. one of the things that we notice in several scenes here, when you talk about Way of the Dead, you're talking about path, right? You're talking about direction. Mm-hmm. And even from the scene of the kid who's running away from the cops, he looks down one path and sees potentially the ghost of Froggy. And Shadow, you know, stops the car and goes down another path and sees the ghost of Shadow. So there's all these sort of dimensions about which direction you go, and in that direction, do you see the dead?
Right, and you end up with Mad Sweeney and Bridget Aloha, Spirit of the Dead, going down basically into the alley, which is a path to to make love. So that was interesting. It was pretty tight that way. So another salient point that I found was we saw Bilkis deny the power of God in the last episode when it came to Ruby Goodchild, the mourner of the dead grandmother and now of her brother, the guy who got died of an overdose but happens to have bullet holes in like a burnt head. But now we see the jinn deny the power of Allah, right? He basically says that Salim is just following what he's been told, and that he's not actually thinking about it, because look at all the people he's surrounded by. How can Allah really be the only God, right? And then Salim basically says, well, the first pillar of Islam is that there's only one God. And Salim's like, well, dude, you're surrounded by God, so what are you thinking? So we see this thing where the conventional deities of today, right, God, Christian God, Islamic God, they're all being diminished, and then they exist, right? They're not non-existent, but we don't really see them. And these old, quote unquote, old gods are like, they're a problem. Then we also hear Wednesday talk about monotheism as a problem. And he also actually mentions Yahweh, the Jewish God, as being a bit of a party pooper or whatever. So they are acknowledging in this TV show what they don't acknowledge in the book, which is that most of the world believes in these like gods, and that these, you know, the idea of one God, in fact, the Abrahamic God, and they find ways to diminish him. And I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's a good one. Another salient point here, or just kind of something that's interesting, is we're having another set of side quests. This whole episode, for the most part, feels very side questy. So one big one, right, is in the end, there's the spear that Wednesday has, and he realizes that, oh, it's not just about, like, it's not just a simple repair of the spear. You now have to get the runes on the spear sharpened by Dwalin, and, you know, getting a potion from Samidi isn't enough for Laura.
Yes, the Baron, right? Getting that potion from him isn't enough.
She now has to find some mystical love plus blood ingredient to add to that to make her be back, you know, whole. So there's a whole set of side quests that we have branching here, and this seems like things to kind of, you know, add more padding to the episodes that we need here, because I don't recall these being in the book, but we'll talk a little bit more about later.
It's pretty interesting. Like, on the one hand, I think you've got these things that are like side quests, but what we are seeing is growth of character through these quests. So there's that. And we saw that before in an episode of Westworld, where they went to sort of Japan world or Shogun world, and it seemed like an incredible side quest, but we began to understand even how Westworld worked, right? The copying of characters from one place to another, because it was transferable. In this case, we see that Wednesday needs these guys' help. They're these giant dwarves. We see that the Jinn and Salim get to grow by talking about Islam and pre-Islamic folklore, like the Ifrit or the Jinn, which was a question I've had for a while. Like, how is the Jinn hanging out with Salim when Salim is a devout Muslim and the Jinn is effectively either a fairy tale or demonic to Muslims? So that was interesting. And I think that when it comes to the potion, what's interesting to me is that I don't know if by making love to Baron Samidi, she was able to gain access to those two drops. Because when he had the vial at first, it was like this little tiny vial with a cork in it. And then when she wakes up, it looks like it was replaced by something that looked more complete, more finished, you know?
So yeah, it's hard to say, because he, at the point, he asks her for truth. And then she ends up making love to him.
And he says that he's definitely in love with his wife, right? Like, he's in love with Bridget. It doesn't change the fact that he sleeps with other people, but he's very in love. So two drops of his blood could suffice. They didn't say that it needs to be Shadow's blood or anything.
Yeah, so hard to say, because she didn't drink it in the episode, or it didn't appear that she drank it. So I guess we'll see. So, Dwayne, how about you give us another salient point?
Right, so it was interesting to see that Bilquis says that she's sustained by the tranquility of love. It's one of the few times we see a god lay out exactly what keeps them alive, right? And what's interesting about that for me is that she calls it tranquility when she tends to eat people with her vagina, right? I mean, calling that tranquility is it's a stretch of the imagination. But given given the fact that she is this person who effectively needs to eat people, needs to eat their love, that of course could give her tranquility. But it's pretty telling, right? And then when the priest says, or the pastor says, "You mean God's love?" She's like, something like that. So again, diminishing the power of these big deities in our world to sort of say what it is that they need to do. So that was pretty interesting. Tosin, Wednesday took a little bit of time on the urination station.
Yeah, Wednesday ended up peeing on Yggdrasil, the world tree, to get it to grow, which it does by the end of the episode. It's very interesting to see it, you know, coming as a seed and becoming more of a tree, because I think in a lot of the other interpretations, it's already a full-grown thing, right? It's not something that needs to be flourished or tended to.
Right, and I thought we saw some vision of it during that scene in season one where they try to sell Wednesday. They're in some government office thing. They show them the presentation on North Korea, right? Yeah. And Shadow kind of tries to leave, but there's this Yggdrasil thing, and it kind of, like, grabs him. Maybe it's foreshadowing, but it's like Yggdrasil was already alive, already big, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting that you have this additional interpretation as a sort of potted plant here. And I guess we'll see where they go with that one.
Exactly. One thing that was interesting to me is when Ibis was telling Shadow about the curse or the hatred that Froggy James had. This idea that, quote, your worst fears are not possible, they're probable, right? Which is interesting, because I think about that as a paradigm for just general life in America. A lot of people think about the worst things happening, right? Like the worst fear could happen. But for a lot of people, when it comes to things like, I don't know, getting stopped by the cops or whatever, it's like there's a probability, like it's not like a far off possibility. There's an actual probability that you could get hurt, get arrested, die, right? And that is the kind of thing that leads to despair. And despair is very interesting when it comes to gods, because it can either lead you away from gods or it can lead you to gods, right? When you're in despair, I don't know what to do. There's nothing for me to do. I can find God and, like, pray. Or I'm in despair. There's nothing I believe in. I can move into, like, nihilism. So I thought that was a pretty interesting thing, because it's not as easy as just saying despair will lead you to me. Now, if you're Ibis, who's a god of the dead, who we should have mentioned him in the beginning, maybe despair is exactly what you want. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Something that I also found pretty interesting is Cairo and the connection of young men of color and sort of the past repeating itself in the future of these individuals getting killed and shot in similar veins.
Yeah, and also ending up, like, destroyed.
Right, ending up destroyed. And
like their bodies.
It's very interesting having the burning figure of Froggy representing that, hey, the past is watching and reflecting, giving Shadow the ability to reflect and see how this sort of future continues to repeat itself. So when they talk about Shadow needing to die, it's very interesting if he may also end up dying in Cairo.
Right. Yeah, I get that. Speaking of dead people, Laura, right? Well, Froggy is trying to give his truth to Shadow. The Baron Samedi basically is trying to pull truth out of Laura. And what he does is that he says that Laura didn't begin betraying Shadow when she had her affair. She betrayed him when she gave her wedding vows to him that she loved him, saying basically that she didn't actually love Shadow to begin with. Which is not as damning as you would, I think, immediately. Mostly because Laura suffered from severe mental illness to the point of, like, suicide, right? So the ability to actually, like, love someone could be more complicated for her than perhaps many other people feel. So the fact that she stayed alive for Shadow, that Shadow found her and, like, kept her from killing herself, her feelings could have been complicated toward him. Not quite the romantic love that we're used to seeing, but perhaps a different thing, right? Perhaps something like a fealty or I owe you or something else. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely agree with you there, where it's hard to understand where Laura's heart is, right? Like, and I guess maybe that's partially because she's been dead, and now that she's gained more life in her, everyone's questioning whether her heart is actually for Shadow, or maybe it's just her eyes. That's why she only visually sees him glow and doesn't necessarily feel him. But I think we'll see a bit more of that as we go a little bit forward. Dwayne, you noticed something else interesting about the timing of this episode.
Yeah, so I haven't spent a lot of time in Louisiana, but the big parade situation tends to be Mardi Gras. When we meet Mad Sweeney, however, he's at some big parade. He's drunk off his arse, and he is kind of like stumbling around before Laura finds him. What's weird to me is that this parade can't be Mardi Gras, because season 2 of American Gods takes place immediately after season 1 of American Gods, and season 1 of American Gods ends with Easter. Now, for those who don't know, Mardi Gras is the Tuesday before Lent, and Lent is the 40 days before Easter. So unless they went back in time, this isn't Mardi Gras. So it makes me wonder when this is. Although the season is right, it is springtime, which you see all around you. But I thought it was pretty interesting that this parade situation was going. Now, I know that lots of festivities happen in Louisiana, but at the same time, in New Orleans, but at the same time, it struck me as odd that there'd be this kind of feast, and Mad Sweeney would be there during this feast, but it's so far past Easter. Like, what's soon after Easter that's worthy of such a revel, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, because when you see New Orleans, you think about Mardi Gras, you think about the beads, which you do see beads out there. So very sort of curious what sort of festivals they have sort of after Easter. And I know they have things like, I believe they have like a jazz and heritage festival and a pride festival. So who knows, but something maybe we'll hear a little bit more about.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of like religious festivals, the djinn tells Selena that he'd rather live as a heretic demon than believe in Allah. Right. And we mentioned this a little bit before, but this idea that this exchange they have where he says, after all you've seen, you still believe in your God, the one true God. And Salim goes, of course I do. The first pillar of Islam is that there's no God but God. And the djinn says something that I thought was particularly interesting. Thomas Jefferson said all men are created equal, but he still owns slaves, right? And given the sort of inequality that the episode wants to talk about when it comes to lynching and other things like that, I thought it was interesting to see that said through the eyes of people who don't have to live that direct experience in America, right? Because they're of Middle Eastern descent. Interestingly enough, if you look at take a look at some census data, people of Middle Eastern descent used to be considered white, and now they're not. So this idea that these guys who were white and now aren't are talking about the plight of black people in America is one of those ways that I think Neil Gaiman tries to get inclusive and kind of flip these ideas on their head. So that I thought was pretty interesting. But then Salim's like, so you're worshiping Wednesday? And he's like, no, I don't worship anyone. I've been hanging in an amulet around Odin's neck for years, and when it suited him, the son of a bitch released me. I'm beholden to him, but he's not my effing God. So I thought that was pretty powerful. So we begin to understand again that Wednesday's been manipulating a lot of people. Especially Salim. I mean, not Salim. Especially the djinn, the ifrit.
Right. So another salient point I have here is what's really interesting is the djinn as well as Salim have been wearing sunglasses for a good chunk of the beginning of the episode. And to me, at least part of the conversations that we hear, it shows how each in their own right are kind of avoiding what's in front of them. So Salim, there's a lot of sort of mystical things that are occurring, but he still is steadfast in his beliefs.
His eyes are clouded, yeah.
Yeah, and the djinn as well as Wednesday, call him out about it. And so I found that sort of very poignant and kind of a unique way of looking at things.
Yeah, that's interesting, especially because there's this preacher, right, preaching to the good child, hey, don't leave, stay. There's all these things happening, you should stick around, all these things. And what we find is that even at the end of the episode, he can't see his faith, right? He's like, if you leave here and you find another place where people aren't catching hell, let me know and I'll come running. he turns to the cross before he says that, and he's basically like, I can't ignore what's been going on anymore in Cairo, which is to say that he almost had been like Salim in the Jinn, wearing glasses, ignoring what's happening to these people who have drug overdoses but end up with bullet holes and burned heads, you know? And suddenly he's like, I see what's going on and it's bad, and you should leave. You should get out of here because nothing good happens here. So that was pretty telling. You know, while the Jinn and Salim are covering their eyes, this preacher's opening them.
Yeah. No, I think that's pretty poignant. And another final salient point for me is that it seems like the old African gods maybe forming a coalition of their own.
Yeah, so there's kind of
a major point made that the white man taught the black man to hate himself. And one of the scenes that I found really compelling and interesting here is we have this scene that has, you know, only black actors involved in it. Actually, I think we may have a couple of those scenes within this show. And one of them is when they're questioning whether or not one of the gods is just there killing black people, when Nancy interrupts Shadow and talks to just Ibis.
Want to get into that during the big picture, but they could be a coalition, but there's no trust there, right? Yeah. So even though we see Nancy and Pilkas kind of like become intimate at the end of the last episode, they don't even talk this episode, and Nancy has a problem with Ibis this episode. So it's interesting that they have these interactions, which I think show that it's less of a coalition and more of like, we do have this thing in common, but what do we really have in common? Not a lot. So, and then last thing in the salient point section is we don't see any of the new gods this episode. It's 100% focused on Cairo and the people around Cairo. It's like they're all kind of saved or like hidden from the new gods here. They're not worried about them at all. Really, like, Wednesday's preparing for battle, so to speak, but there's no immediate threat. I thought that was pretty interesting. We also don't see Sam Blackcrow, which is interesting because the whole thing takes place in Cairo and she lives there, right?
Yeah. So I think that brings us to the end of our salient points. We're going to move into questions. So the open questions that we had during this episode. Dwayne, I'll let you kick it off.
Right. So basically my question was, there's this zany sex scene. Did the Baron and Bridget basically use their powers to have Laura and Matt Sweeney have like sex, like hate sex, you know, like, and what was the point of that? What was the overall point of them having Matt Sweeney and Laura get together? I guess I just didn't get it. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, it was very synchronized and artful. It seemed like sort of a way of getting to play with the camera and do something stylized, but I'm not quite sure the reason behind it, to be honest. Unless it was supposed to be some sort of like metaphorical Laura's actually having sex with Mad Sweeney, even though they're not, because one is saying that Mad Sweeney himself is attempting to say that, hey, he's not just driven by Laura. Kind of hard to say, to be honest.
Yeah, it was pretty weird. I mean, I feel like you know, a lot of these networks have shows that are, you know, for grown-ups, and so there's going to be a sex scene and hopefully that'll get viewers or whatever. I didn't quite see where the plot went with this, but I do think that there's something about exacerbating the drama between Sweeney and Laura by having them pseudo have sex together, right? Because those two spend a lot of time together. Just the nature of the fact is that she's got the coin inside of her that he needs to live and she needs to live. And so now that they've had pseudo sex, how does that work, right? So it's pretty interesting. What was your question, Tosin?
So there's this scene where Shadow is going down a path, and there's a dog there that he follows, and I think the dog kind of disappears, to be honest. What does the dog represent? Why is it included here?
Yeah, so Mr. Jackal, we don't really get to see, right? But we see Mr. Ibis. And if Mr. Nancy's supposition is right, that Ibis and Jackal are finding ways to kill black people so they could have them in their funeral home, then, I mean, I would imagine that dog represents Jackal. And he's leading people to that. But it's unclear. And one of the reasons why I think the dog could be Jackal is also because they've got this cat that's like an anthropomorphized cat. It's a cat, and then it's a person. It's a person, then it's a cat. So it stands to reason that Jackal could be a person, then be a dog. Or a Jackal. Right? So.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So I think that's the thing. My second question was, did Laura take the vial left to her by Baron Samedi? She didn't drink it on screen, but she saw it. She seemed to palm it, but then she doesn't have any pockets, and she's just kind of angry when Sweeney shows up. So it's unclear, right?
Yeah,
and it's a huge plot point if she took it and it didn't work. So I kind of want to know what happened.
Yeah, me too. I'm quite interested as well. And the other thing that interests me is we hear throughout this episode that Shadow has to die. Well, what's going to become of that thread? Will that be fulfilled? Is that an empty promise? Does he physically have to die, or is this more of a metaphor?
A lot of foreshadowing, no pun intended.
Dwayne, what's your next question?
So Salim and Jen, they're on the bike. The bike breaks down. Mr. Wednesday comes and picks them up and grabs the spear. When they went to the porn palace, when they got the spear, they also got this little kind of leaf. And it seems that the magical leaf is also the same Yggdrasil that Mr. Wednesday pissed on to grow. So how did Wednesday get his hands on the leaf? But then, you know, Salim and the djinn aren't with him until he goes to get them. It seems like a continuity error, or am I just missing something?
Yeah, I don't really understand where they're going with that one, but I guess we'll wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, on the flip side, we do have an answer to a previous question. We once asked what exactly Betty the car was, since she was able to literally stop a train on its tracks. If the motorcycle is Freya's mount, as Mr. Wednesday said, a magical boar, then maybe Betty is Thor's legendary chariot. It's drawn by two goats, but, you know, maybe it's a twin turbo. I don't know. The bottom line is, things are not what they seem, and the reason why that bike could kind of just show up at the dwarf's place, even though it wasn't working before, was because it's got certain sanctions to it. It has a part to play. And so Betty might be just as magical.
So those are our questions that came up from this episode. Let's move on to the big picture. So this is kind of where we talk about events that we and what we know about them that impact the overarching story arc. So Dylan, I'll let you kick this one off.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got a whole bunch of deities, right? And we'll kind of take turns talking about them. But Yggdrasil, we saw a version of it in season one. Here it is, renewed with Urin. It's the world tree. It's basically the tree that that in the Poetic Edda, the original 13th century Norse mythology thing, it's the center of the cosmos. And it's very holy. And the gods go to it to assemble at their meetings, do traditional governing, all these things. So it's the center of everything for someone like Wednesday or any of the Norse gods, right? The second person we meet is Froggy James. He's not exactly a deity. He was executed in 1909 in Cairo, Illinois. And his story is pretty much what we learned in the episode. This dude was executed. And there's pictures of the crowd that was around when he was executed. And it is a humongous crowd. Like it's just this gigantic crowd of people in 1909. And because he was implicated in the murder of this white woman, he was singled out and he was taken. And so not a lot is known about the actual justice of the event. It's just kind of known that he was killed. And it's unclear what evidence was against him, because it was a mob killing, the kind of thing that's not supposed to happen. So that was pretty crazy. But moving on from that ghost over to the Norse guys. Tosin, what do you have?
So we have Alvis. So from the book, what we learn about him is, and let me read a section from that book, where Shadow asks, "Who was that?" asked Shadow as he drove down the ramp, grinding the gears. "Just like he said, Alvis, son of Vidolf, he's the king of the dwarfs, the biggest, mightiest, greatest of all the dwarf folk. But he's not a dwarf," pointed out Shadow. "He is what, 5'8", 5'9? And Chernobov responds, "What makes him a giant among dwarfs? Tallest dwarf in America." So that's how we were introduced to Alvis in the book. Now from the show, Alvis is a dwarf, you know, from Norse mythology, as we noted here, which his name actually stands for All Wise. What we learned about him from Norse mythology is that Thor's daughter was promised in marriage to Alvis, and Thor was unhappy with this match, however, so he devised a plan. He told Alvis because of his small height, he had to prove his wisdom. And Alvis agreed, but Thor made his test last until dawn, when Alvis, because he was a dwarf, was turned to stone when he was exposed to sunlight. So that's...
Yeah, totally interesting, especially because we think of, because of Tolkien, we think of trolls as being frozen in sunlight, not dwarves. And we also think of, especially because of Marvel, we don't really think of Thor as clever enough to pull off such a trick, right? He's kind of this big dumb oaf with a hammer. And so the idea that he can trick this dude is one thing. But we don't really meet Thor during American Gods. So Alvis is free to not be turned into stone. What's also interesting is that he's like a foreman of a factory, but the factory is no longer working, which kind of might tie into this idea of, you know, the American Rust Belt and how it's no longer doing what it used to do, and building things because we've had globalization and other whatever, and so on. So he is also missing worshipers and devotees because you don't have those people building cars or whatever they are. So that's pretty interesting. It's also interesting because the whole sunlight thing, he turns into stone. He was definitely in a dark, dark place, right? Both physically and I guess mentally. So there's that. So we've also got my favorite elf ever, Dvalin, D-V-A-L-I-N-N, but it sounds a lot like Dwayne, so I've always been into him. In Lord of the Rings, the name is referred to as Dvalin, which also obviously favorite. So he is considered in American Gods the Rune Master, right? The person that is supposed to know that, but know all these runes. When Wednesday asks if anyone's seen him, it's interesting because in old mythology, he's the sleeping dwarf, right? He's the one who's unconscious. He's in hibernation. And so he's hard to find because he's never awake. So it's going to be interesting to see if they actually follow through with that, or what else they said to do. We've also got Hildisvini, right? And that's the bike we talked about before, right? When we talked about Betty, is Betty really a car or something else? Hildisvini is the bike that the Jinn and Selene were riding on, and it's Freya's battle boar, which is also sometimes her lover, which is one of those things that you just have to get over when you're reading like mythology from back in the day, right? So
yeah, I'm always confusing battle boars and lovers. It's a hard thing.
I don't even know what a battle boar is. It's like, it's, I guess you don't eat it, you ride it. I don't know. But at the end of the day, this is Freya's mount. Well, not the fact that she's her, it's her lover sometimes, and that she rides it, it's her mount, doesn't jive well. So, forgive my chuckles, but that's pretty much what she's about. So the fact that this bike is her mount, it's relevant to the kind of stuff we talk about here when it comes to the old gods. So that's pretty interesting. And then finally, when it comes to these people, these supernatural people, we've got the Loa, right? We talked about them briefly before. Baron Samedi and Mammon Brigitte are both Loa. So Loa is part of the French Caribbean, French African tradition. So you'll find them in Haiti and in Louisiana, and they are the invisibles, the intermediaries between the Bondu, meaning the good God, who's the supreme creator, and the world. So in that worldview, the Haitian Creole worldview, the Louisiana Creole worldview, God is very far from the earth, and you need these Bondis, Bondus, to be the messengers back and forth. But they're not angels like how they are in regular Christianity, right? What they are is these like kind of spirits who have all this mischief going on, and if you treat them right, they'll get your message to God, which is why you have now an opening for voodoo, right? Sacrifices and so on. They want stuff from you in order to give your message to God. So not only is the Baron Samedi a Loa, he's the leader of the Gwedi family of Loa, and they represent death and fertility. So his job when it comes to talking to the god, right, is for resurrection and for leading the dead into the underworld. So if you treat him right, he might bring you back to life. But otherwise, he'll take you to the underworld. Now, Mama Brigitte is also a Loa. She's from Ireland. And she's the only voodoo Haitian god that's not African descended. She's Irish, so she's white. She's associated with the Celtic goddess of spring, fertility, healing, poetry, and smithcraft, which gives you an idea of the kind of human transfer that was going on back in the days where Creolism was put together, right? So the Creoles are people of mixed descent. They're African, they're European. And in the Caribbean, you would find plenty of Irish people there, and they would go and look for opportunities wherever they could, which explains how you get an Irish person in the middle of this situation when they're clearly coming from what was then the British Empire, which was in competition with the French Empire. So Mama Brigitte and Baron Samedi married, showing a sort of bond between two types of people, which is exactly what the Creole were in the first place. So it's pretty interesting. But Tosin, speaking of bonds, the Djinn, Mad Sweeney, what's their bond to Wednesday?
Yeah, so they are both beholden to Wednesday. They both owe him for something, but they both really don't like him. It's kind of interesting to see as this thing develops. We've seen Mr. World like call out like, hey, he really needs to get folks on his side, getting ready for battle. He notices that Wednesday has a lot of people who seem loyal to him and who seem that they're kind of building, being part of his team, part of this army. But when you find out this details, kind of makes you question, you know, what does that really mean for their loyalty in the war to come, where they're beholden but don't really like who they're fighting for? Is that really loyalty? Will they, like, flip on him at the moment's notice when they don't have to?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear the Djinn isn't so happy with him. And then basically Mad Sweeney kind of curses him out. He hates that guy, which is kind of how he gets in with Laura, right? She thinks, oh, you're just doing this for Wednesday. And he's like, no, I hate Wednesday, but I owe him. So what does Wednesday have on these guys? Wednesday's clearly manipulating a lot of things. We know he's manipulating Shadow. So what's going on there?
Yeah. Dwayne, I think you got one last one for us.
Right. Big picture. Truth. The Djinn tells Salim he's entitled to his own truth, but not his own facts. We've heard that, opinions and facts, before. The Baron tells Laura that she's lived her truth, and that living that way was no betrayal. And then he gets into her truth that, again, she may not have ever loved Shadow. So there's this idea of truth with these non-gods, these people who were mortals, like in the case of Laura, she was a mortal, or Salim, that the truth they're looking for, the truth that they think they have, it's theirs, and that's fine. But it doesn't really jibe with the way the universe actually works, which is supposed to be, I guess, a little unsettling or whatever. So that might be a foreshadow for what we're going to see throughout the rest of the season and into season 3.
Great. So we're going to take one last break, and then we will wrap up this episode with significant changes to the book and performances.
All right, it's 27:12. Okay, let's bang into it. 3, 2, 1. Tosin?
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out, do I say welcome back or do I just say...
Yeah, yeah. Welcome back. Here we are with significant changes from the book.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
3, 2, 1. Welcome back. You're here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin...
Oh, wait, set that over again. I'm Dwayne D.
Dwayne D, right?
Yeah. Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back. You're here with Dwayne D and Tosin Anafawakin. Andy's still sick. Hopefully getting better as we speak. But now let's leap into significant changes from the book. So, you know, one of the first things that we notice here in the book, we don't actually meet any of these recently introduced gods in this episode. Kind of the way the show's characters meet them. Some of these we hear about at the side, but others don't necessarily exist. So that was kind of a big thing I noticed.
Right. Even getting into the whole Louisiana thing, there's this whole side thing about Haiti and like slavery that Neil Gaiman gets into. And then there's this other thing with, with the dwarves. We're not, you know, it's not Salim or the djinn. I mean, the djinn really, his role is pretty small in the entire book, but they've expanded it here. So Shadow is the one that meets the king of the dwarves, right? So there are a couple things that happen, and again, I think it's because they're trying to expand some characters, right? Take some characters and expand their understanding and help us get to know them better, so we can get how they're going to behave later when like the push comes to shove. We also don't see Matt Sweeney and Laura having mystical sex. That threw me for a loop.
Yeah. And you know what else threw me for a loop? Seeing Shadow get cursed or possessed.
Yeah, and this is where one of those things where I kind of see where Andy, who gets a little frustrated with the show, I see him where he comes from when he gets a little frustrated. Shadow being possessed didn't seem to offer anything to the episode, right? He gets up in front and possibly embarrasses himself a little bit, whatever. But like, It gave us nothing, with the exception of an excuse for him to ask some questions to the three gods who were having a drink and then get angry and walk out. I mean, if that was what it was set up for, it didn't seem like the juice was worth the squeeze. I just didn't really understand it. But, you know, getting cursed or possessed, I guess, you know, whatever. let's put this flicker in his eye. Let's spend some money on special effects. I didn't really understand what was going on there.
Yeah, were there any like performances or anything that stood out to you in this episode?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking forward to the Mom and Brigitte performance, but really what took it for me was Mustafa Shakir as Baron Samedi. He was charismatic, he was powerful, he was bawdy. He was exactly what you think that character is if you've ever read about him in folklore or anything before. So he reminded me of when we first met Pablo Schreiber as Mad Sweeney. Just the perfect encapsulation of these characters. So that was good for me.
Yeah, you know, I'd say overall the cinematography in this episode was pretty good. And even the sex scene was visually well shot.
Yeah, but it was somewhat gratuitous, but it wasn't like
overindulgent.
Right. So on the one hand, it wasn't like, you know, you watch Game of Thrones and like the sex scenes all seem a little bit rapey, and that's no good. But here it was people like ruled by their passions. It definitely didn't hold a lot back, but at the same time, you were interested because it wasn't just some situation where two people were rolling around the sheets. They were four people being dynamic. They had to convince one another to get into it. And when they did, they seemed, for lack of a better term, unbridled. So it just felt like it worked. I just am not sure what the true intent was, other than to kind of put Laura and Mad Sweeney into this position of intimacy tied to awkwardness, which, you know, kind of makes sense.
Even the harsh reality of the opening, right? The opening lynching and shooting and hanging, like, that was very powerfully done.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so, and is kind of a very shocking way to start any episode.
Yeah, it was incredibly shocking. It reminds me of kind of how they're doing this thing with the CEO during the last episode. And I'll say that I'm pretty pleased with these openings being a gateway into the sort of the fault line or the foundation of the actual episode, right? The opening creates a premise for the episode to sit on top of. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, do you have anything else to add in here?
No, I think we're pretty good. I think we're in really great shape. If you haven't, grab a copy of Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology. He retells a whole bunch of Norse mythological stories, and he gets into some of these characters that we met this week. So that's what we're doing as a bit of ephemera. But other than that, I think we're good.
Yeah, well, I guess that brings us to the end of this episode titled The Ways of the Dead. We will join us next week on The Dominant Paradigm, where we talk about the next episode of American Gods titled Donar the Great.
Love me some Donar.
Yeah. Thanks. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys. Andy, feel better.
Yeah, get well soon.